It's Magnum Podcast. I'm Jason Snell, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-hosts, Philip Michaels and David J. Lohr. Hi, guys.
Magnum! Magnum!
Sorry, I'm a little bit down, fellas. And the reason why is a very close friend whom I've never mentioned before and whom you've never met before just was murdered, and it's really bumming me out. So I'll pull myself together. With a little Annie Potts in my life. Hi, Annie Potts!
Magnum! Mm-hmm.
I'm a big reader. I also like volleyball. I think in Ghostbusters it's racquetball, but it's close enough. Yeah, Annie Potts is back because we watched AAPI a few weeks ago, the episode full of callbacks to episodes we haven't watched on this podcast, so slowly perhaps we will go to them. This is Season 3, Episode 19, Legacy from a Friend. The first appearance of Annie Potts is Tracy Spencer. Later I'm going to ask you guys to explain to me what exactly her deal is, because I think I got very confused by her.
She is very confusing.
Her web of misdirection.
Her web of lies just caves in on her from the get-go. Before we get too deep into this episode, Jason, I'd like to introduce a new segment that I'd like to call Remembrance of Magnum PI Episodes Past.
Okay.
I think this might be an old segment. You mentioned AAPI, which we talked about a few weeks ago. Jason, it would help right now if you, in post-production, add some wavy sound effects and maybe a clip of us joking it up about that episode.
Oh, yeah, that's a great idea, Phil. Let's think about it now.
Oh.
Whoa, that was great.
Wow.
What a great thing I did there, if I remember to do it.
Yeah.
I remember that time we considered putting in a flashback sequence.
Well, let's think about that sometime.
So what about it, Phil? What do you want to remember from a previous Magnum podcast?
This has been haunting me since we recorded this episode. There's a moment where Luther Gillis, everyone's favorite recurring character, is mad at Magnum because Magnum has he's interrupted Magnum's carefully laid out plot with another blundering exercise. Magnum's yelling at him. Luther yells back at Magnum, and the argument ends with Luther saying along the lines of, "You're being a real scrunjo here," and then storming off. And I believe all three of us miss this reference to the second most beloved character, Scrunjo.
Scrunjo from the jail.
Yeah, Scrunjo from the jail.
It is in my notes.
I can't believe we didn't mention Scrunjo.
Yeah. And
shame on us.
I take Magnum Podcast very seriously. Mm-hmm. Listeners, I can't speak to the professionalism of my other co-hosts, but I, for one, will never fall down on the job again. And if there is a Scrunjo mentioned in any future episodes,
Phil, I will do you one better. I will guarantee you that if Scrunjo is referenced in a future episode, it will be time for our new segment, What's Up with Scrunjo?
I wanted to get that off my chest, and just to add that in this episode, Legacy from a Friend, no references to Scrunjo.
No.
Thank you.
I mean, in a way, if you think about it, considering all the recurring characters and all the people who came back, even for just two episodes, Scrunjo is kind of the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of Magnum P.I.
Sure.
He's always getting in trouble.
Yeah. Tom Stoppard wrote a play about him.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's right. So this is an episode, yes, Annie Potts is back, but first, as Phil alluded to at the top, we have Magnum's very good friend, Marcus, who we've never met before. Well, although I feel like at one point Magnum in this episode says he was a good friend of mine, and then basically backs off like, well, we played volleyball together.
he was my teammate.
He was my partner on the beach volleyball court. By the way, Marcus Phillips, played by legendary, according to Magnumania, your source for Magnum and beach volleyball information, legendary beach volleyball player, St. John Smith, which explains why Marcus is a bad actor and dies quickly.
He's a good volleyball player.
I can verify that he is, in fact, him and Karch Karay or Karay?
Karay
were the preeminent beach volleyball players of their generation.
Yes, indeed. So. Indeed. And he brought his brother and another ringer in those scenes. And obviously the people who made Magnum PI were so excited that they had these good volleyball players, and they have Tom Selleck in there playing with them. Obviously limited what they could shoot, because I believe in the first scene in this episode, within 40 seconds, we see the same thing repeated again. Like, they didn't have more footage. So Magnum goes up for the same shot, is encouraged using the same dialogue as he is slightly moments before in the same scene. But they liked it so much that all the end credits also are beach volleyball shots from this scene with Magnum and his very, very good friend who he plays beach volleyball with all the time. We never see that part of Magnum's life. Magnum has a rich life that we know nothing about, because it's not connected to crimes until now.
Right. This is from the early years, mm-hmm. where they made an attempt to give Magnum a life outside of what we saw. And I kind of like that.
Right. Trying to suggest that he is a well-rounded human being and not a character in a TV show with a very limited number of supporting characters, which is...
And that he only has three friends that we see every week.
And it's got to be one of them. Yeah.
I would also like to point out that I think the producers recognized the acting limitations of St. John Smith by having him killed almost immediately.
Oh, yeah. Clearly, but not before he has that line where he says, this is a car that I got. Don't worry, Magnum, I have a fancy car. Well, goodbye. And then he's dead, because
he's such a good actor. He's killed off screen.
Yes.
We don't even get that.
No, Magnum gets a phone call from Rick saying, look, Marcus, it's Marcus. You got to get down here. This is in the middle of the night, but by the time he gets to the beach, it's light out. But Magnum can't believe it. His sister Nancy runs in. She's very upset. It would seem like Nancy's going to be an important part of this episode.
Maybe they decided that, all members of this family get one scene. Also, my favorite bit about Nancy is that she's introduced as this sweet kid who came from Illinois for a life in Hawaii.
Yep. Followed her brother out.
First off, not sweet at all. She mostly just yells at Magnum, like Magnum killed him. And second off, I can't really place that accent in any part of Illinois that she has.
No, it's perplexing too, because all she really does is yell at Magnum and suggest that he should immediately stop investigating her brother's death, which could be like a red herring or something. But like, literally nothing comes of it, or her, and then we don't see her. Like, her behavior is inexplicable, or at least just begs to be explained.
Yes.
And is never explained. And you know, just taking the outside perspective, this looks to me like something that got, you know, that the character got cut out of a script revision, but they cast it and they kept part of it in. And so they have her in there, but it doesn't make any sense as aired, at least. Maybe as shot, they shot more stuff with her, but she doesn't really go anywhere or do anything.
Or even it could be like the original Pink Panther, where David Niven was supposed to be the main thing. That was the reason you were watching the movie. And Peter Sellers was so good, they kept adding stuff with him. And I wonder, because I have written down multiple times in my notes, so much chemistry. You know, they got a load of Annie Potts with Selleck and went, oh, we got to do more with this.
I'm not sure in a weekly TV production environment they're capable of that. It may also be that they just cast Annie Potts and they're like, oh, let's pump up her character, pull out that Nancy stuff. Right. And before they even got to shooting, they realized that with the casting, she would be a better get for this. But Nancy's just kind of wasted. I do enjoy the direction here, and it's Stuart Margolin from The Rockford Files who directed this episode, which makes me laugh. There is some really fun direction where, if you know that Annie Potts is in this episode, which you do because the giant all caps yellow type that says Annie Potts comes up, but she's in the background of the scene where Magnum's on the beach and Nancy's yelling at her, and the camera, she's standing there sort of waiting for them to finish, and it pans past her a couple of times. I really like that. I like that. As opposed to sometimes the blocking in fact, even in this very episode is very stagey and not logical for like reality. But that I thought really worked, where like she's just standing there doing her thing and we see her in the background, and then it turns out that it's like she's an extra or something, except she's actually important. I like that she's just hanging out back there in the background while Nancy yells at Magnum.
Is she merely a beachcomber?
We don't know.
Uh, a beautiful vision from the sea. We'll never know.
Is she an undercover cop, or is
no,
she a meter maid?
She is not. Yes, exactly.
Like at that point, if you've seen California, or yeah, was it California? No, Corvette Summer. It's Corvette Summer, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you've seen Corvette Summer, you're like, hey, that's Annie Potts. Mm. And she hasn't really, I mean, if you've seen the sitcom The Good Time Girls, you know, various sitcom things, if you knew who she right. was, you'd know who she was. But most people didn't know who she was
and
yet.
She's she probably shot Ghostbusters shortly thereafter shooting.
Yeah.
Shortly after shooting
it's
Legacy
within
from
the
a
year
friend, because yes, it came out the next summer.
This is 1983.
Mm-hmm. So they have Magnum ID the body, which is funny because they just again no St. John, it's fine. They kind of like unzip the bag and Magnum kind of doesn't respond, which I thought was funny. It's like, Magnum, tell us if it isn't your friend. Otherwise, just remain silent and we'll assume that it is your friend. So
and there's a family member right there.
She's
and it's
right
supposed
there.
To be a family.
Well, he's
member.
Trying to protect her. I think that's yeah. the idea. Yeah. Besides, this is one of Magnum's very close friends. Who we've never heard of.
And never will see again. So, goodbye! I get the feeling he was in town for like a volleyball tournament and took a day out to film some Magnum stuff. And that was what they had him for.
Yeah, or they, you know, or they paid the beach. Yeah, you're probably right, is that the beach volleyball tour was coming by and they were like, can we get those guys to be in a scene for a day? Mm-hmm. And use it in an episode.
Or send us a guy, and it just happened to be St. John Smith.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot easier than those touring rodeos mm-hmm. that come
it's
out.
True.
There.
It's true.
Yes, you got to plan those 6 months in advance because of the quarantine.
So Nancy is angry. You just let this be, Magnum. Isn't his death enough? Which, again, very weird. Is like, no questions. My brother died tragically earlier tonight, and... enough. Like, okay. But we do get to meet Annie Potts. She introduces herself as Daisy Spencer. She says she was Marcus's fiance.
Or near fiance.
Yes, right. But still, they're a connection that even though, and there's a good moment of like, well, I've never heard of you. And he says, well, I've never heard of you. Ha!
Yeah, well.
Even before that. So he has, this is like Robert Hamilton in full eloquent monologue mode. He's so poetic in the volleyball thing. And then he's so poetic mm-hmm. when Magnum goes to Marcus's house. And it's all, you know, I was never good at funerals. And I paid tribute to Marcus in my own way by going to the beach or, well, breaking into his house.
Yes.
Okay. And so he's looking around the house and he lifts a little black book. This is a detail that I'm still puzzled by this. Clearly this is an actual house that they used because it's pretty well lived in. And on this wall unit that Magnum is lifting the book from and looking through, mm-hmm. there is a pair of Bert and Ernie puppets.
There are a pair of Bert and Ernie puppets.
And not only a pair of Bert and Ernie puppets, I had the identical pair of Bert and Ernie puppets. They had these weird foam arms, but they had hard plastic hands and heads, and they were really hard to operate. And they're just like jumbled there on a shelf at Selleck's eye level. And they never, they're just there.
Well, David, as a writer, you know about building characters, right? And throwing in those little details. And just as this episode is trying to make us, hey, you know, Magnum has a life when he's not solving crime. You know, Marcus has a life when he's not being murdered and driving fancy cars. He's
Marcus has a strangely whimsical love of the Muppets of Jim Henson.
He's a lifeguard and an aspiring puppeteer.
And I would like now to use that as a perfect segue into our new segment. Anton Chekhov criticizes Magnum P.I.
Hello, this is Anton Chekhov, and I would like to speak about what is happening with the puppets. As you know from my classic works of art,
Mr. Chekhov, before you can
no questions. Anything placed in a scene must be used later, and I defy you in my version of this episode, Legacy from a Friend. At the end, there is a revelation involving Bert and Ernie puppets. But does Robert Hamilton do that? No, he doesn't. It's outrageous. Chekhov out.
And they should be going to Moscow.
See, he's gone.
End.
That's the end of the episode, I guess.
I'm so sorry. I was hoping to ask him to say his, after Chekhov's gun. Chekhov's most famous saying is, of course, nuclear vessels. So yes. I wanted him to say that.
See, if you deploy Chekhov in the first act, he has to go off by the third act.
Yes. Well, it turns out he went. That was a little one act play there.
Yeah.
But yes, Bernoulli or not, they are literally Chekhov's Muppets there, and they never go off. So, what can we do?
Here's your episode title. that's our new segment. Yes. There's your episode title.
Chekhov's Muppets. Annie Potts, by the way, doesn't believe it either. I find this funny because Magnum's like, no, I'm not going to investigate. But he continues to investigate. Also, I've got a question that comes from later in this episode, which is Magnum breaks into a lot of houses.
He sure does.
And what I admire about, because he's a detective, of course he breaks into houses. What I admire about Magnum's technique in breaking into houses is when he's in someone's house, or any place he isn't supposed to be, and somebody is coming in and is going to discover him there, you know what he doesn't ever do?
Hide
or run.
No, because he's a very hiding would be foolish. Man. He's a very tall man.
I just love the fact that he's like, oh, well, I guess I'm going to have to BS my way out of this one every time.
You caught me. No,
yep, I mean, first of all, he's really charming. Uh-huh. He's really tall.
Yep.
And he's inevitably going to start giggling. And that giggle, I mean,
yep.
You know, it gives him away every time.
So he just doesn't. I admire that.
And besides, you know, he's not a cop. He doesn't need to go get a warrant. It's not going to, like, jeopardize his investigation, the fruit of the poison tree. So what does Magnum care?
I mean, he doesn't even lie about being a cop.
Anyway, no. I like that Magnum, even though he's like, oh, yeah, Nancy, okay, he totally doesn't buy it, and he's investigating it, and his voiceover suggests that his inner conflict. Annie Potts says she doesn't believe it either. But then Magnum sort of doubled back and goes, oh, but Nancy, and she's like, well, what are you doing here then if you're not investigating this? Good question, Annie Potts. And Magnum is kind of conflicted.
And again, being Robert Hamilton in the early years, you have a lot of I had my little voice told me something.
Yeah.
When I write that book about being the world class private eye, I'm gonna write a chapter about listening to your little voice. And I should have listened to my little voice. And so you get all that, and then you get an I know what you're thinking, and an I know what you're thinking again, and I appreciated the again.
Yep.
Because unlike Ruben Leder, he actually pays attention to how many he puts in a script.
Well, he had his little I know what you're thinking abacus that he kept by the typewriter as he was working.
There's a lot of voiceover in this episode. Higgins has a ghastly smile. Old buddy, old chum. I got you those Tide shirts you were looking for, pal, chum, old buddy. He needs a favor, and the favor is I'm going to give tours of the grounds, so you have to vacate your house for the next 3 weekends while I give the tours. And if you do me this favor, I will wipe out, I'll basically not tell Robin about your various crimes against the estate, including the one with the Romanian mime troupe.
I think you're overlooking the potato chip heiress in the title pool.
Another of the great crimes. But Robin already knows about that one.
But not the Romanian mime troupe.
And that's when Magnum points out quite rightly, well, this is just extortion. Yeah.
It's like, I'd like to consider it a gentleman's agreement, but yes, that term is abused these days. Oh, I loved that whole scene.
What's Romanian for yes and? Because I would love to know.
And the gleeful he hands the tube of Tide charts to Magnum. And then he's just smiling and smiling and smiling. And it leads to, I texted you a picture of this.
Yeah.
To Tom Selleck in that scene, he is clutching those Tide charts like they're his blue blankie, and he's giving this look like I cannot believe Higgins is doing this. He's a maniac. It's like he's holding onto the Tide charts for dear life, lest he be swept away into the insanity of this situation. It's a really laugh out loud kind of take from Tom Selleck.
Jason, that is not the only thing that Tom Selleck clutches in the scene. He also begins rather menacingly, I think, playing with a crossbow.
Yes, he does.
No reason.
Points at his Higgins at one point.
Yes. What do you need a crossbow for, Magnum?
And he uses the crossbow to go to the fridge and get a beer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you hunting the beer man?
I don't know.
I don't know.
That's not how you play beer hunter.
This episode, I think, should be called Stage Business, because all the characters are just given things to do that have nothing to do, ultimately, with the show.
But I do love speaking of callbacks.
This is Anton Chekhov again. I want to point out that the crossbow is not fired in the rest of the episode. Another key mistake, Robert Hamilton, call my people.
Say nuclear vessels.
Chekhov.
Damn it.
Oh, he's
never in time.
Maybe he'll do it in the third act.
I mean,
now that we've hung Chekhov on the wall, you never know when he's going to come back.
Oh.
Yeah, okay, go ahead, David. Go ahead.
I lost it. I
will say
it.
That Rick comes in here with one of the... So wow. If you talk about the structure of a detective plot, and this one... Like the plot of this, it feels like this is from a flowchart in a book about how to write a plot. Like it's just, but the part that really stuck out to me as being non-inspired is Rick appears to say, "Hey Magnum, we did some things and looked around some things and found out where Marcus's car. Here's your next plot point, Magnum. Marcus's car was leased by Chase Shipping. Now, when bad actor St. John Smith got into the and legendary beach volleyball player, just to be clear, bad actor." Legendary beach volleyball player. When he got into his car, there is a moment where a blonde lady in another fancy car drives up, and there are looks exchanged, sort of, as much as looks can be exchanged by an amateur actor. And then here we discover that lady with the Bentley is the lady from Chase Shipping. So it's all... obviously connected,
and she's important because she is the other person from the guest cast list at the top of the show, Rosemary Forsyth, who I recognized at the time as having guested on WKRP as the woman who tempted Mr. Carlson into an affair, but he stood firm.
Rosemary Forsyth, who is not an actress that I recognized, but I was shocked to find out she won the Golden Globe for Most Promising Newcomer in 1965. And she also won another award and was nominated for another award as a Most Promising New Star. And not to be too harsh, but that didn't really work out for her.
Well, if the Golden Globes say it, so I don't know.
I mean,
it
must be true, right? She was not, and perhaps she had family issues or whatever. She's in a Columbo. She's in a bunch of TV movies. She made a bunch of guest star appearances, but as a winner of a Promising Newcomer Award, she kind of, didn't. Her career was not particularly notable. A lot of guest star roles, she worked for a very long time up through 2008 in a bunch of stuff, but. Rarely more than just a guest appearance here and there, but
Olsen,
she is.
But
here
Belisario's
she is.
Jazz.
She is the grumpy blonde in the fancy car. And what's her connection to all of this? We'll find out in a little bit. Annie Potts reappears. Now she has a badge and says her name is Tracy. Okay. So she says she's an undercover detective. There is a great moment in here that shows that she and Magnum are meant for each other, where he says, "You're a cop," and she says, "Undercover detective."
Yes, I love that.
Yes.
That was so good.
So good.
So, as we should, as listeners should know, Magnum is always correcting people who call him a private eye. I'm a private investigator.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. And so she's got the same thing here, which... Yeah, unfortunately, it's all a lie, but it's a nice moment.
No, I mean, I can forgive everything else about this episode just because of the two of them.
Yeah.
They're electric together.
I don't forgive, David.
It goes a long way, but not as far as that.
It's not as far as it should. Yeah. No.
I had an 80s cultural moment when they are staking out the blonde lady, Ms. Chase. At the Well, I mean, it's like a restaurant, but it's outside because it's Hawaii. So they're sitting outside and they're looking at the menu. And Magnum says, it's easy for you to say your menu doesn't have prices on it. And I thought, well, okay, let me explain, people who are not from the 80s, that at certain fancy restaurants, the women's menus wouldn't have prices on it because it would be assumed that the men would worry about the pricing. Women just should not worry their pretty little heads over it and just order whatever salad they would like, basically.
But it's not that fancy a restaurant because it has the thing that I hate in restaurants where someone comes around to the table and tries to sell you crap because it has the lady who's selling the flowers or the little flower arrangement. So clearly this is a Wahoo tourist trap.
It's a tourist trap.
And naturally Annie Potts makes Magnum buy her a thing. Magnum doesn't have a smaller bill because the wrist corsage is like $2.
Yep.
And Magnum says, I only have a $5. And the lady selling the flowers goes, oh, that's fine. And just takes the money and hightails
and leaves.
Oh, my goodness. Yep. That is bad service.
Yep. That made me laugh. That was pretty good. And then Annie Potts says, take my hand. Now laugh. Because her friend is going to the powder room and I'll follow and make sure she doesn't get back for a little while. So you can talk to the lady and Magnum goes over to Miss Chase and asks about Marcus. And she says he is a part-time houseboy.
Mm-hmm.
Did a little bartending at parties. But Magnum says, I've got his little black book. Has that happened now or does that happen? No. Annie Potts knows he's got the little black book later. Yeah, so anyway, they have a moment and she basically says, you're rude, Mr. Magnum. And he goes, yeah, well, you know, it's a job. And
he actually says, well, murder is pretty routine.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
This is hard-boiled detective dialogue 101.
You know what's more rude than rude? Murder.
Murder. Yeah,
nothing
you got me
more
there.
Ill-mannered than murder. Take that, lady.
Impertinence.
Murder can be used to trump anything that you throw at a person. You're very unprofessional. You know what else is unprofessional? Killing people.
My friend dying. Very unprofessional. Okay.
You know what's another segment we can introduce? Murder.
Oh, no. Sure. We could at any time.
But we won't.
Annie Potts knows that Magnum has the little black book. That's what it is.
Yes.
And she also sweet talks Higgins.
Oh, this scene. Again, delightful scene with Annie Potts. Annie Potts, we love you lots the rest of this episode. Yep. Not so hot.
Is it time, Phil? Is it time for our We Love Potty About Potts segment?
Potts in it. Plot scene about Potts, not potty about Potts. Good God!
Well, I mean,
that's
the English,
a separate segment.
I meant the English, the English part. It's like crazy about. Anyway,
I see. This bit is great. She is just flattering Higgins, talking about his cool head and his keen eye, and obviously a detective of Magnum's limited intellect. He must turn to you all the time, and Higgins is both.
You must be his mentor.
Yeah, you must be his mentor, and Higgins is all. To help Magnum with his sordid divorce cases? Yes, I do. I can't deny it. It's great. She plays him like a fiddle.
Well, and I like that Higgins is struggling with accepting compliments versus having any bit of it reflected toward Magnum, where he's like, do I want to really even admit that I'm involved with Magnum in any way because that's beneath me? But then again, it is a compliment.
This is the height of early season Magnum Higgins, early series Magnum Higgins conflict, where they are not good buddies. They still are trying to get one over on each other. And I just like how Annie Potts wraps Higgins around her little finger and it disgusts Magnum. He does not care for that at all.
She then tries to get, and if you figured out that she's lying about being a cop, then the scene is actually funnier because she's like, you know, civilians always muck this stuff up, but you know, I'll make you a deal. You could work with me. I just can't tell the people back at the station. And he's like, no, I don't want to work with you. No. Of course, then, you know, cut to, I know what you're thinking again.
Yeah.
And he is doing her bidding,
well,
basically.
Yeah. Two heads are better than one.
They're
That's his reasoning.
They're in Chinatown. They're doing reconnaissance because I guess that Marcus, when not pursuing his love of puppetry or his lifeguarding or his volleyball, uh-huh. also dealt in hot goods.
Yeah, so this is another,
how he was able to afford all the puppets.
This
yes.
is another one of those connect the dots plot kind of things that happens here, which is he goes down there and is talking to say, did you see this guy? He talks to a lady who is selling stuff, played by Julia Nixon, who I recall as being the commander's girlfriend on Babylon 5. But she has been in other stuff too. David, do you want to tell a tale related to 2 degrees of separation from the Gold Monkey now?
Well, I mean, it could be a Tales from Tales of the Gold Monkey. It could also be a new segment called Frost Nixon.
No. See, David, I would have gone with Nixon's the One.
Oh, all right. Let's go with that. Let's go uh-huh. with that, because there's no frost.
There's
annoying.
No frost involved. No. That's the problem.
but of course, because all the networks had their 1983 fake Raiders of the Lost Ark shows, and NBC had Casablanca, which starred David Soul, who is married to Julia Nixon.
Yeah.
And that's not really Tales from
Tales of the Gold Monkey Gold at all. Monkey. But anyway, no. She's the one. She gets this one scene where she's there with the big hair and she says, you know, he was selling stuff.
He turned my brain into tapioca.
Yeah, well, yeah, she says that he was easy on the eyes, just like Magnum.
Yeah.
But she's there. Literally, this is one of the most thankless jobs in acting. You see this with all those stage actors who have to do Law and Order parts to make a little more money. And it's the character who is used in one scene to provide information to advance the plot. And so she says he was selling stuff. He had a big bankroll at the end of the day, but somehow he never seemed afraid. So something is going on with Magnum's buddy where he was selling a lot of really nice merchandise out here on the street. Suspicious. But before we can go any further, the best and most exciting scene in Magnum PI history happens.
Yeah, this is where this episode veers delightfully towards insanity.
Yes.
And then pulls back, and yes. you're all, oh, yeah. you should have kept going.
Magnum is stopped in Chinatown because he's treading on Rose's turf, whatever that means, by a comedy lady duo in stretch pants, essentially.
Yes.
They're kind of like the low-rent TV comedy version of Bambi and Thumper from Diamonds Are Forever.
I was going to say, this is sort of like Jane Fonda's Enforcers. That's sort of what's going on.
They look like they've wandered out of a Jane Fonda workout video.
Punch into the oldies. Something like that is going on here. They attack Magnum with kung fu, and I'm not making that up. The ladies in the stretch pants attack Magnum with kung fu. At one point, he says, "I've never hurt a woman before," and the lady says, "Well, maybe it's time you started." And then she kicks Magnum again.
I would also like to point out that the blonde lady is very into kicking Magnum in the face. Her facial contortions. She is the polar opposite of great volleyball player, bad actor St. John Smith, in that she found her motivation. She really wants to kick that Magnum is what this segment should be.
There's
called.
A little technique here too, where you know the whole. Not to get all film school on you, but the whole mixage montage, the whole idea that you take the lady kicking and then you cut to Magnum flying back and it gives you the impression that she's actually kicked him, even though she hasn't, because that's not, you know, there's a stunt actor and all of that. However, the opening pre-title sequence for this episode just features her ludicrous kung fu kick. And then it cuts.
And her weird growl.
And honestly, it's hilarious. And so when you get to the moment where she does that and then it cuts to Magnum flying back, it's like, no, you've already ruined it. Because I've already seen how ridiculous that kick was in isolation. So no amount of film editing is going to make me believe it's anything other than a very nice lady in stretch pants kicking toward a camera lens.
And it gets even better because when Annie Potts shows up to stop them from kicking Magnum by basically screaming impotently at them.
If you figured out that Annie Potts is not a cop and is lying about it, this scene works a lot better because she comes in and she says, "Freeze, police," and she doesn't have a gun. She's just kind of like using her hands and they run away.
Purse, yes. But the door behind them is locked. So what does blonde lady do? Oh man, she
yells
kicks that
at
door.
It.
She uses
yells
kung fu,
at the door.
Kung fu powers
to kung fu to kick it.
Yeah, kung fu powers kick on that door.
I suspect she actually locked that door ahead of time. So knowing that I got this.
Yeah.
I'm going to kick it with my foot and press all my coworkers.
Here is a great moment to introduce a new segment that I bet could be a spinoff.
Uh-huh.
This is a good one. There's precedent for it. Cop or not?
Oh,
cop
yes.
Cop or not? Is the guest a cop or not?
Well, we're about to find out.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's a segment. That's more like just a...
Well, it's a teaser.
It's a plot point.
All right. Okay.
I mean, at what point did you figure out she was not a cop?
Well, when I watched the other AAPI, and recounted her tortured history.
Yes.
Then I sort of went into this episode going, she's not a cop.
Yeah. That's right.
She's a meter maid.
That's right. But it is a funny thing that she freezes. She just does it with her voice. Freeze, police. And they buy it. Like,
yeah,
they buy it, even though she does not have a gun. And then Magnum says, "Why didn't you pull your gun out?" And she says, "Well, it got caught in my makeup case or something," but it's obviously ridiculous.
It got tangled in my makeup case.
And,
which is not how guns work at all.
So, no. So, back at the estate, Magnum has got ice on his face because he's been bruised by all the kicks from the lady in the stretch pants. And Higgins is much more concerned about Annie Potts. So once again, we've returned to this dynamic, which is Annie Potts is very interesting. Higgins knows it and is much more interested in her than anything dumb that Magnum might be doing, like almost being killed by a kung fu lady. Rick and TC come back with more important plot clues because, again, they got to advance the plot. That's why Rick and TC are apparently there. They somehow talked somebody into looking in the car.
Yeah, this was a really I don't often go back and watch the episode twice, but as I was gathering my thoughts today, I realized I remembered absolutely no details of this plot from a show I had watched 3 days ago.
Yeah.
And so I went back and watched a large portion of the thing, and I still don't know what they did with the car.
It literally, I think this must have been multiple drafts of multiple different stories that they just sort of shoved into one thing because it literally does not make coherent sense.
Rick and TC walk in and they say, "Hey, we talked somebody into letting us look in that car, and we found this in the glove compartment." And it's a note to take you to the next scene, which is the roses import export. And we know that they said this is Rose's territory. But literally, it's just sort of like at this beat in the plot, you need something that sends Magnum to his next destination. And so Rick and TC walk in.
It's a quest.
It's a quest. Although it does have the moment, which is we can find those girls who beat him up, and they went girls, which I know it's sexist, but also I like it because they're enjoying.
It was a funny moment.
They enjoy Magnum's failures.
It also really speaks to the inattentiveness of that car rental company to not thoroughly clean its cars.
Yeah, that there are clues in the glove compartment. Yeah, well, maybe
gross.
Yeah,
gross.
Well, and if we were paying attention, the ladies both had roses painted on their cheeks. I don't know if they're supposed to be tattoos, but of course, actors are not going to get tattoos.
Right.
But that shows they're Rose's girls. And we find out that Rose is played by Bob Minor, who was Roger Mosley's stunt double and the stunt coordinator. And really, the stunts should have been better in that case. The girls should have been just a little better at kicking him.
Yeah, so they go to Rose's place. Saying. And then the stretch pants ladies are there. This time Magnum is tired of getting beaten up, so he does punch the lady,
He just walks right up and decks her.
Yeah, I love that.
Now
it's acceptable. See, it was like they almost turned to the camera and go, "Now I can hit her."
Yeah,
because
that's right.
She was going to karate kick me again. I was a gentleman the first time.
So he says, "You just found Rose," which leads to a scene that is completely ludicrous where these two morons, namely Annie Potts and Tom Selleck, are going to pretend to want Marcus's action with Rose. And they're like, what kind of merchandise can you get us? He's like, oh, top of the line, the best stuff. Well, it better be. Oh, trust me.
Also in this scene, Annie Potts is not dressed like a dirtbag, not dressed like the sort of person. She's very composed and very lovely and not at all the sort of person you would take to, well, I've got to make my new business connection with my guy who's going to launder my stolen goods. So I'd better dress to impress.
She's the accountant or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Since Rose himself wears rose pants and a rose vest with no sleeves.
Yeah.
This is the most remarkable outfit in the history of Magnum P.I.
I think...
I'm sorry that my voice has gone up 8 octaves. I'm very upset.
We're breaking Phil
again. I think Annie Potts also is sort of playing like a gangster's mall here.
Except that's the implication. She's lighting the cigar.
Yeah, but
he's like, this is my girl, you know, and she's sitting on his lap. And it's,
all right,
again, stage business. So that's all it is.
Yeah.
And it causes Rose to observe, your game is lame. Well, that is true.
Yeah, accurate.
Yeah.
So lots of
lameness.
But they're like,
on.
Bring us the stuff. So then Magnum, because he's a very dumb person, decides to load a bunch of valuables from the estate into a truck. And they're like, oh, but we wrote down
because
all the serial numbers,
away.
So we can get it. Yeah, we can get this stuff back later, but we'll just load up with TVs and speakers and stuff, and we'll put that in as the stuff that we're gonna unload, and it'll prove ourselves to them. This is their dumb plan. And they're like, well, why don't you put your stuff in here? This is another thing that I thought really was very funny, which is Magnum's like, well, it can't be my stuff because I'm not materialistic. I just don't acquire things. Like, cool, man.
I don't spend my money on
things,
which is a great line.
Yeah, it's because Magnum doesn't have any money. And he's a freeloader. So they go back, and yes, indeed, Rose and the Stretch Pants Mafia are there. This is all part of maybe Magnum's B plan, which is he's like, all right, Annie Potts, call in your backup, your cops. Which is not properly set up. I feel like we should have had set up that, like, you're going to have the cops ready to back it up, but I don't believe there's any reference to that. So then Magnum just turns around and says,
isn't.
Call in your backups. And she says, well, I can't.
Well, because Rose and the girls have pulled guns on them.
Yes.
And he goes, oh, you're going to rip us off. And Rose is like, yeah.
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 Yeah. Of course. Yeah. This is all, they've got their crappy truck full of stuff from the estate, and they're going to be ripped off. And he says, call in your backups. And this is all fun. Like, Magnum kind of knew this was going to go on. But it's like, now call in the cops. And Annie Potts says, no, I'm not. I'm not a detective. I'm a meter maid. Which leads to, I actually think, the most logical thing to do in a situation like this, which is Magnum just accelerates the truck through the warehouse. It knocks off all of these supporting, like, beams so that a bunch of stuff drops on the ground. It's like that video of the Russian warehouse where the thing rolls into the other thing and all the stuff falls down. If you remember that thing, it's like that a little bit, just a little bit. And the truck just keeps going and blasts outside the other side of the warehouse. I thought that was really hilarious and fun. And the truck is basically wrecked. And they, as they're shooting at them, as they get away, the TV gets shattered, of course.
And their truck is shot so that it's like lurching down the streets of Hawaii.
Yeah.
It's a fun visual. However,
okay.
However, not to criticize Magnum's strategery here, but they literally pull the guns on them.
Yes.
And Rose and his two lady friends are standing maybe 2 feet in front of the truck.
Yep.
And I'm thinking, Magnum, just accelerate into them and killing them instantly. They won't be able to fire the guns in time as they're being crushed. Just drive into them, Magnum. They'll be dead. But Magnum never does that. He just
He's a gentleman.
I don't know.
Yes,
I think
clearly.
Perhaps they just have gotten out of the way, you know, and that's how he's.
No, they wouldn't have had time. They wouldn't have had time.
I don't know. That's an old truck. It doesn't accelerate very fast at all.
They are standing very close to the truck, Jason.
Okay. All right.
We're going to hold you at gunpoint and check your oil for you because we're a full service thuggery agency.
So Thomas is tired of being lied to, and Annie Potts tells him her whole story about wanting to be a cop. I don't understand.
Hang on. Before you get there. So they go back to the estate.
Yes.
They're unloading the truck and getting all the stuff to put back into the
broken
TV.
Estate,
which leads to, I love the sight gag of her and Selleck carrying the broken TV. I mean, just shattered from the back. And they're just discussing whatever without any acknowledgement that the TV is totally destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just love that moment. And then TC and Rick are done. And TC just turns and goes, the next time you want to get me in one of these things, include us out. And I just thought, a Sam Goldwyn reference? What? Because he was famous for saying, include me out, please. And I love that.
So can you guys explain to me why Annie Potts is doing this? Is she is she related to Marcus in some way? Or did she just like find this? How did she find out that this was happening?
I envision that she has a police scanner. Because as she says, she gives her whole backstory, which is that she's the daughter of like, I'm the daughter of a billion cops and all her relatives are cops.
My dad was a cop in Cincinnati and I grew up with 27 uncles, all the guys at his precinct.
Yes.
I was the only one to go to my prom with a full police escort.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, so, all great. She ever wanted to be.
How did she get in on Marcus's thing?
She wants to be a cop. She can only be a meter maid because of her eyesight. Annie Potts wears glasses. She's delightful.
Yes.
But
she looks so good in them.
What I imagine is that she's sitting home at night after a long day of meter maiding, listening to the police scanner for crimes that she can. The cop's going, oh, I don't know how we'll be able to solve this one. And Annie Potts goes,
that big break.
This is me, my big break. Yeah. It's stupid, but
a drowned body was found on a beach. Aha, it's probably murder and not just drowning.
In 2021, there are tons of Twitter accounts for different cities' police scanners that people retweet and make jokes about and they follow, and I don't get it.
Yeah. I follow the one from my hometown because it's great. But if they were doing this episode today, imagine the folly of trying to do Magnum PI today.
Oh, boy.
They would.
Don't do it. It's a bad idea. You probably shouldn't do that.
They would have an episode where the Annie Potts character would be a murder podcast person trying to find her next big serial style thing that's going to put her on the map. My dad was a podcaster, and I was raised by 27 podcasters. Yes, my dad was Jason Snell.
Yeah, please enjoy when you get to that part of Rutherford Falls on your new Peacock subscription. That kind of happens in that show.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Okay, the little voice comes back. There's one more thing to try. I love this scene. He is on a boat that is going through like a little canal to get to the backyard of a house that he walks in. And again, he walks right in. He doesn't care that he's discovered by Margaret Chase. Because again,
who
he doesn't hide
about in just, like 20 hours.
No,
to continue with the theme of stage business, there was no reason to have. You could have had him skulk up to the front of the house or what have
no,
you.
No, he's in a boat.
Instead, he's in a boat in the many canals of Hawaii, I guess. Whatever.
It is I, Anton Chekhov, back again to explain if your detective is in a boat at this point in the
vessel,
story, or any other sort of vessel, it must be used in a chase or to drown him or something, but to have him unexplained arrive in a boat and never depart in it is unacceptable. Unacceptable! Chekhov out!
Because, see, now we had to follow Roddenberry's gun, which is if you have Chekhov, he has to say Wessels.
Or at least the specter of the gun.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
She says, oh, I just want the truth. She's like, oh, you want me to pay you off too and all of that? And he's like, no, I just want the truth. She says, well, Marcus was like a little boy, which is funny because that's what Magnum says early on, right? It's like
he sets that up.
He never really grew up. Yeah.
Like I was 32 and I was 33. No, I was 32 and I felt that I had been 22 and I was suddenly 32.
Yeah.
Which is something he said in the pilot differently with different agents.
Right, but, okay. But he says that he recognizes this in Marcus.
Right.
That he's
Marcus never grew up.
He never grew up.
Which explains the Bert and Ernie.
Oh. Okay.
Ah.
This is Anton Chekhov again. I do not accept this theory. Chekhov out!
She says you're right about the blackmail. It was Rose. He just wanted to make money to impress me. He thought if he made more money, then I would leave my rich husband. And I never really imagined he'd fall in love with me. But it wasn't murder. What a twist. It wasn't murder. I guess he, I don't know, fell off the boat and drowned?
Which we're told isn't possible because he was a great athlete and a great lifeguard.
Class.
And that was his day job.
Almost world-class swimmer. And yet this is dropped here, and then we never get any more because Rose shows up, and she just says it wasn't murder. It's never resolved.
Nope.
No.
Nope.
It's a detective show, everybody. It's Magnum's best friend or something like that. Was it murder? I guess not. I like the twist, actually. I like the twist that all of this stuff is unraveled and the illusions he has about his friend's life all kind of come up. And in his death, all of the dirty laundry gets exposed. I like all of that, but I would like a little more clarity about it. But like, I like the fact that there's a twist that actually he was out there with them. Maybe they've been drinking. He got very upset. He fell off the boat or he jumped off the boat intending to swim to shore. And it was a terrible mistake. Like, I'd be okay with that, but it's never handled like that. She's like, well, she blurts, it wasn't murder. And then Rose appears with the Jane Fonda mafia.
Yeah.
And that's it.
And it's very, I mean, it is breaking the cardinal rule of show, don't tell. It's just tell.
Yeah.
And it is kind of like, oh, we've read out of pages. We have to finish this.
Which leads to the most theatrically blocked scene in the whole episode, which is Rose demanding more money, or should we tell your husband about your dalliance? He moves around and stands behind her and does a bunch of like business, and it's very much like super stagey. Like, look at me. I'm normally just a stunt double, but not today, everybody. Not today.
I get to act.
Oh, there's a lot.
With my rose-colored vest, I'm the center of attention.
Bob Minor is doing it up. It's fun.
More like Bob Major.
I just want to say, we're making fun of this, but Bob Minor's Hamlet was transcendent.
So...
never stopped moving.
They take Magnum away. So I guess Rose has decided that they're going to get back at Magnum for all of whatever his shenanigans are, getting in on his territory and fighting
They're obviously going to kill him.
Yes.
because he knows too much. Now why they have to
drive him somewhere?
Drive to the killing room. I guess
we don't.
He broke Rose's warehouse.
Yes.
It's a whole vengeance thing.
Yeah,
you're gonna repair this warehouse. Then we're going to kill.
They
you.
Could literally just
you
shoot him and dump him.
Did.
Dump him in that boat in Chekhov's boat.
If only there were a canal right near the house where they could dump the body.
But instead, they're gonna drive him somewhere and. That's when Annie Potts emerges from nowhere and rams them off the road with one bump. She picks up a gun that has been conveniently ejected and says, freeze, and fires it and doesn't miraculously kill anybody.
While adding to the miracles of this car bump, both the girls who are holding Magnum at gunpoint have guns trained on him in the back seat, and upon impact of both the car slamming into them and the car then slamming into a tree off the road, no one fires their gun. No guns are discharged.
I guess
they have the safeties on, so full credit to them didn't chamber the first round. I don't know.
To paraphrase Carrie Fisher from 30 Rock, never go with a fence to a second location.
No, well,
of
I mean,
course not.
Unless they force you to, because a gun.
Yeah.
But fortunately, a gun flies out of the car, and Annie Potts picks that up and then fires it, but doesn't. It's a zany misfire.
And again, I don't want to introduce a new segment called Phil's Gun Safety Tips. But if she were to fire the gun the way she is holding the gun, she would have powdered burns galore. The backfire on the gun would have broken those pretty little glasses of hers. Uh-huh. And
she could have sprained a finger. She could have dropped it.
Rose and the muscle ladies, who are basically useless once they've been in the car wreck. So much for your karate lady.
The gorgeous ladies of wrestling. Yes.
Dazed.
Yeah. After she fires the gun and loses control of it, they would be, are you kidding me? And then kill both her and Magnum. No, don't fire a gun like that. Anyone.
So what I like about this scene is that after we end up with Annie Potts with a gun and Rose and the two ladies and Magnum, cut to volleyball.
Yep.
So
it's how you honor him.
What? What happened next there? Do they call the cops? Does she just make Rose kneel down and take care of him execution style? I don't know.
I can only assume they call the cops, because in the next scene we find out that her application to become a full fledged police officer is being accepted.
No. This is incorrect. This is Anton Chekhov. The correct way to end this episode clearly is to tie up the miscreants and then portray before them a sort of puppet show involving Bert and Ernie, the characters from earlier. But alas, again, Robert Hamilton, you did not follow my advice. And this is my final appearance because you knew I would come back. You knew it. Chekhov out!
The beautiful thing is, had Chekhov written this episode, we would have had all three, Rose and the karate ladies, we would have had them facing their ennui with their lives as they currently stood.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
We would have had about, you know, I don't know, 20 minutes of that. It'd be great.
Yeah. Volleyball. I guess Chekhov's gun really is just the game of volleyball. Beach volleyball, which returns here. Yeah. What happened to Rose?
You don't have a volleyball game in the first act without returning to it in the last act of the episode.
So Magnum has a new partner and presumably a new best friend, but Annie Potts needs a letter of recommendation from Magnum. Wah, wah, and that's the end of the episode.
Yeah.
I will say Stuart Margolin's staging of the cherry orchard at a Pasadena Playhouse was kind of stunning because of all the beach volleyball.
That's Legacy from a Friend, an episode that has a lot of delight in Annie Potts. It has hilarity with the ladies who do kung fu, and Rose, the most scene chewing over the top villain you're ever going to find. The plot doesn't make a lick of sense.
Nope, none.
Rick and TC are merely used, like Julia Nixon, just as elements. They are the lines connecting the dots in the plot, so they're not really useful.
I don't often quote Dennis Miller, but I heard him use this phrase once, describing himself in a movie as an expositional eunuch. someone who never gets the girl, never gets action, just there for the plot.
You're referring, of course, to his character in the Sandra Bullock movie, The Net,
in which
Dennis Miller is then killed after fulfilling his role as an expositional eunuch. Spoilers for The Net. Speaking of volleyball, so anything more about Legacy from a Friend? Because I do have a listener letter to read.
Oh my God! I'll just do my stupid little bit before
do
that.
Your stupid little bit.
Yeah, Karch Caray is Uncle Vanya, Misty May Trainer, and Misty May and the other lady are the three sisters. I only know two lady volleyball players.
This has been a new segment. Phil's stupid bit.
Yeah. Okay.
No, that's not new.
That's not new at all. No, that's the
entire... We're calling it out. That's the subtext.
You know what we call Phil's stupid bit, Magnum Podcast? Thank you.
There you go.
There you are.
And I do have a return to our segment In the Mouth of Magnum. If you will turn your attention to the Zoom chat.
No.
Yes.
What are you
doing? The best segment of all. The visual segment.
It is.
These go, they'll go in the show notes and they go in the chapter art if you've got a podcast player. That
no, throw your listening devices into the sea.
That's
everyone.
Right. They're look in a coconut. Useless you at might this see point. It there. Oh, it's a beach volleyball thing where Magnum is holding a giant like a cabbage or something.
It's a turban, but it looks like a volleyball.
It doesn't. Not even a little. It looks like whipped cream.
And we also have a shot of Magnum being exasperated by Lego Annie Potts.
I just want to go. It looks like Magnum is in the pie fight scene from the Great Race.
Shirtless,
but yes, and yeah, that, sure, I'll buy that.
There's
as Annie
no
Potts.
Glasses.
No
on
glasses,
Annie
though.
Potts.
You know,
her most prominent feature.
I was trying, but she doesn't wear them in the whole episode. She goes back and forth, which is interesting because she keeps saying that the reason she couldn't become a cop is because of her eyesight.
I'm sorry. That's Magnum with Tyne Daly. I'm sorry, David.
Oh, that's the Jororo kill then.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
All right. We have one listener letter. Remember, you can send your letters to Magnum at theincomparable.com.
Or
please do.
Or the other method, Jason, via the coconut.
You crack open a coconut. You whisper lovingly into the coconut, rub the coconut with your hand.
Reseal the coconut. This is a
yes,
very important step.
Yes, bury it in
step.
Your backyard. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Plant a little gravestone above it that says RIP coconut.
David creeps into the backyard at night, takes the coconut, leaves a Lego figurine in its place. And
or a Lego coconut.
Yep.
And 9 months later, a beautiful baby is born.
Uh-huh. That's how it works. A stork. Yep. A beautiful stork baby is born.
Yep.
To deliver other babies. Listener Adam writes,
hello,
I didn't
Adam.
Have a coconut handy, so I figured I'd drop you a message here.
Oh,
Adam, you're lazy. Boo.
This is about the music. I asked the question a couple weeks ago, the segment of Before the Credits.
Uh-huh.
The music used in the pre-roll first appears in Season 1, Episode 5. It's used as a sound bed while Magnum is trying to pick the lock in the guest house before the lads get him. They started using it for the episode intros on Season 1, Episode 11, and then the main theme changed on Episode 12. I went back to Episode 5 to confirm Adam. It's absolutely true. Magnum gets to the gate. He can't get in. He goes over the fence. He has to run across the lawn and then get in before the lads attack him. And when he finally picks the lock on the door and gets inside, as the lads jump on the door, you do indeed hear, da-da-da-da-da. So
well,
that's
Adam
where it's from.
Adam is now the most useful person appearing on this podcast.
Ever on the podcast.
Well done, Adam.
So thank you to listener Adam for confirming the Mike Postiness and Pete Carpenteria-ness of that.
I used to do all my shopping at Pete Carpenteria.
At Carpenteria, well, I mean, for remnants, rugs, area rugs.
When I worked my way through school as a Carpenteria at Starbucks. Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the end, believe it or not. I think we've done all the damage we can do for 1 week on Magnum Podcast.
Holy God, did we talk about this stupid episode for a long time.
I don't know how it happened. Next week's episode will probably be much shorter.
I would hope so.
But that's it for this episode of Magnum Podcast. Thanks to everybody out there for listening. And thank you to my co-hosts, David J. Lohr and Philip Michaels. Bye, guys.
After all that damage, I'm going to pay you $20 a month until I replace that TV.
Good day, chaps.
Chums.
No, he said chum, you're right.
Chums.
Oh, shit, I screwed it up. I even wrote it down. I didn't even look at my phone. And oh, God.
This is Anton Chekhov. This podcast is over.